wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM and streaming at kboo.fm. KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO listener members and support from Portland Underground Graduate School, a local independent learning community offering courses and workshops for continuing lifelong learning. Course options and more information online at pugspdx.com. This is Laurie Mercier, your host today for the Old Mole Variety Hour, where each Monday morning, the collective of agitator moles provide interviews, reviews, and views from an underground perspective, which we hope lead to greater understanding, reflection, and action. Patsy Kohlberg is our engineer. The Old Mole burrows down to the roots of the great issues of our time, the struggles of ordinary people for democratic and sustainable ways of life. The mole goes where corporate media fear to tread, supporting grassroots challenges to top-down authority and giving voice to movements that shake the foundations of an unjust society. You can subscribe to or listen to the Old Mole podcast by going to our page on the KBOO website, and you can also find there links to past shows and segments with further links to even more useful information, including how to follow and contact us. Leading off the hour, the mole's Bill Resnick talks to Middle East scholar Stephen Zunis about the torture murder of the journalist Jamal Khashoggi, the Trump administration and the new Saudi crown prince, and about what might be done and what is happening across the planet to save the Middle East and ourselves. Fran Michel reports on climate change and authoritarian states and how capitalism is responsible for both. Then I discuss with Mary Wood, professor and director of the University of Oregon Environmental and Natural Resources Law Center, the Julian case, the trial of the century to be held in Eugene beginning October 29th, about the youth plaintiffs who, on behalf of future generations, are holding the U.S. government responsible for climate change. They demand that it and governments worldwide reduce carbon pollution within their jurisdictions. And to end the show, Larry Bolden reviews Tana French's brand new mystery novel, The Witch Elm, which is anything but predictable and takes readers so far into her characters and her twisted plots that readers must wait for the ending to be finally released. Now, here is Bill Resnick with Stephen Zunis.
Stephen Zunis, welcome to KBOO.
Great to be with you again.
Stephen Zunis studies and writes on the international system and its politics. He specializes in the Middle East, also U.S. foreign policy, and strategic nonviolent action. He teaches at the University of San Francisco, coordinates its program in Middle Eastern Studies. He's active. He writes. His best-known book is Tinderbox, U.S. Foreign Policy and the Roots of Terrorism. Stephen Zunis, how do you understand, what are the factors behind the torture murder of the journalist Jamal Khashoggi by the Saudi Arabian secret apparatus?
It appears to be comparable to, I guess, the murders some Russian agents have done, apparently, to dissident journalists and others, and those in inner circles who effectively go in exile and defect and say critical things about the regime. They wanted to set an example. They wanted to make sure to be a deterrent, I guess, to other dissident voices, especially those that are articulate and have a following. And of course, they thought they could get away with it. I mean, this is a regime that has gotten away with this terror bombing of Yemen, which is responsible for tens of thousands of civilian deaths. You know, they're responsible, you know, for the brutal crushing of the pro-democracy movement in Bahrain, the siege and threats against Qatar, not to mention the incredibly brutal internal repression. this is a regime that's gotten away with all sorts of things, and they figured they could probably get away with murdering this dissident journalist.
Yeah, and they also, part of the reason they thought they could get away with it is because they've received so much support from the Trump administration in every conceivable way. Trump is so proud of his having sold, he inflates the figure, but billions and billions and billions of dollars of armaments and everything else. He's a great businessman, and he keeps announcing that.
Oh, yeah. You know, presidents of both parties, of course, have sold hundreds of billions of dollars of armaments and other security assistance to the Saudis, politically well-connected corporations like the like Bechtel, which is based here in San Francisco and has close ties to the Republican Party. They've overseen some of the huge mega construction projects as the kingdom has built up its infrastructure. You know, there's a lot of money to be made, though I should also mention that these arms sales are subsidized in terms of the air shows, the subsidies, all sorts of various credits and the like at taxpayer expense. So in certain ways, it's not just Saudi money coming in. It's, the U.S. taxpayer is also helping this relationship as well. It's not that these aren't arms grants like U.S. provides to Israel and Egypt, it's certainly something that our tax dollars go to support to some degree as well.
It seems to me previous administrations were very supportive of Saudi Arabia, but they also made some kinds of efforts to keep them from, and especially to keep their the radical plutocratic militarists in Saudi Arabia in check to some extent, and also to try and persuade them to stop funding Islamic radicalism around the world, which they've always failed in, of course.
I do think you're correct that there is a qualitative shift under Trump to be much more effusive and unconditional in praise of the regime. It's the first country that Trump visited after he became president, and generally, we've seen other parts of the world as well. Trump's support for autocrats, and you can't get much more autocratic than the Saudi regime.
Than the new Saudi regime, yeah. Apparently, a couple days ago in Montana, he saluted their congressional candidate there, who body slammed, attacked, was found criminally responsible, but just a misdemeanor, a journalist, a interviewer who didn't like the question, and he treated the journalist as the enemy of the people and purveyors of fake news and evil, and he loved this guy who attacked the journalist. This is just after the Saudi apparatus had killed, and there's killing going all over the world, actually, of journalists. Mexico is probably the king of killing, but the Russians do pretty good too, of critics.
It was rather shocking that he would explicitly not just support a candidate who did that, but actually praise the candidate for having done so.
Yeah,
he's my kind of guy for committing an act of assault and battery against a journalist who simply asked a question that he didn't like. The Guardian newspaper, for whom the journalist was working, issued a formal announcement, as did the British government, which is where the Guardian is. Guardian's based in England. I mean, it would be shocking in any case, but particularly on the throes of Khashoggi's murder. I think it's underscores the autocratic mindset that Trump carries. And I should mention an interesting little tidbit that hasn't gotten as much attention as it should about Khashoggi, was that he was dismissed from his post as an editor in Saudi Arabia and ended up going into exile, not for criticizing the Saudi regime, which came later, but an article of his, this is back in December 2016, when Trump was president-elect, criticizing Trump's Middle East policy. That's what got the Saudis upset and started to crack down on him and forcing him into exile. And so one has to wonder if the cavalier attitude that Trump has been taking regarding Khashoggi and the murder and his, seeming acceptance of the Saudi version of events and trying to take the blame away from the crown prince and other people at the top who appear to have indeed been responsible. I mean, it may be indicative that he's been mad at Khashoggi for criticizing him.
Yeah, he really does. He cannot take critique, and he is furious and vicious, and now he has the power to kill people. This is KABU Radio, 90.7 FM. Bill Resnick here for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm talking to Stephen Zunis. He's a foreign policy writer and teaches at the University of San Francisco. Also advocates, and we'll talk about the power of resistance and nonviolent resistance to topple these dictators in various places. His best-known book is Tinderbox, U.S. Foreign Policy and the Roots of Terrorism. Stephen Zunis, tell us about Saudi Arabia, Saudi Arabian politics, the ascent of the current crown prince, Mohammed bin Salman. It seems to me it arises out of Saudi Arabian domestic problems as well as international problems. In some ways, they're getting cornered, and they were getting cornered by the Arab Spring, and they were frightened. And his aging father, the king, who apparently is extremely ill with one or another form of dementia, appointed this Mohammed as his successor. Tell us about what's happening in Saudi Arabia and why they're in such trouble in the long run. In the short run, they look sort of powerful. At least they can kill vast numbers of children in Yemen and other places. But in many ways, they're weak, particularly in the long run around the future of Saudi Arabia.
King Salman is the last of a series of brothers and half-brothers who have ruled Saudi Arabia for decades. And Mohammed, his son, is only 33 years old, and it really is the power behind the throne, really is the de facto ruler of the country. So he is of this younger generation who, has made a number of minor reforms, trying to clean up some of the corruption, at least when it involves rivals within the royal family and the elites.
Well, he's actually shaken them down, right? He imprisoned many of them and would not allow them out of this.
Mass arrest. At least one person was tortured to death. That was an army captain. Yeah, the way he went about it was highly questionable. But on a seemingly anti-corruption purge, which Trump has praised, he's also, for the first time, allowed women to drive, while at the same time imprisoning leading women's rights activists, including those who were leading in that movement. He's also opened the first movie theater and allowed for a little more Western music and things like that to come in. So in doing all this sort of thing, he's been challenging some of the more reactionary Salafist clerics. And because of all these things, he's gotten great praise of and the not just from Trump, but in the Western media. I mean, he 60 Minutes did a puff piece on him a few months ago, and there have been various articles in major newspapers and magazines that were similarly a positive. Oh, here's the young reformer taking the kingdom into the 21st century. And basically, it's very embarrassing for the United States, frankly, to support such an absolute monarchy like that. I mean, remember, the United States was like the first country to really have it to have a Republican revolution against an absolute monarchy, and this is something every kid in school learns about, right? The American Revolution, everything, and here we are in 21st century, 250 years after the Revolutionary War. And the United States is the world's number one backer of the world's remaining absolute monarchies, including that of Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, not to mention the dictatorships that the non-monarchical army dictatorships that are powerful.
supporting authoritarianism in general is pretty bad, but it's particularly ironic, you know, given U.S. history, that we are friends with these family dictatorships, these hereditary autocracies.
Right. Stephen,
and Saudi Arabia is among the worst, and the double standards and the hypocrisy of American policy is extreme.
This is Bill Resnick for The Old Mole talking to Stephen Zunis. We're talking about Saudi Arabia, the United States, the murder of Jamal Khashoggi. Let's get Stephen to Trump and Mohammed bin Salman, the new crown prince, very, very aggressive and murderous, and quote the reformer, who also is somewhat popular, particularly with young people in Saudi Arabia. Apparently, they really go to the movie houses and like to now listen to once banned music. It seems to me that Saudi Arabia is in deep trouble, and we really have to talk about that. One of them is the Shiite rebellion that Iran supports, like the compromise between Shiites and Sunnis in Lebanon, which was supported actually by Syria, another enemy of the United States. Tell us about the problems that Saudi Arabia faces. One of them is from the Shiite rebellion throughout the Middle East. But another one is their long-term problem. They're so dependent on oil, and climate change is going to wipe out there. They had some agriculture. It's going to wipe them out. It seems to me that Saudi Arabia is going to get so hot that it's going to become impossible to actually produce things or live. Tell us about the long-term environmental problems of Saudi Arabia.
Well, the whole Middle East, like the rest of the world, climate change is having an impact. And in the Middle East, we are seeing increasing drought and higher temperatures. And despite our stereotype of Saudi Arabia as desert, most of it is desert, there are areas in the eastern mountains where there is some agriculture. And the drought and other problems, of course, have contributed to the instability in Yemen, where Saudi Arabia has gotten embroiled in that civil war. But Saudi Arabia, of course, is a major emitter of carbon through its petroleum industry that the United States and other Western nations have encouraged by buying their oil for many, many years. The Saudis, with their wealth, have built these incredible modern cities with everything air conditioned and fancy, and it's such that many Saudis don't have to actually be outside in the heat. But you got to wonder how sustainable that's going to be in the long term. And again, the slight rise in temperatures in a place that's already one of the hottest in the world is going to be disastrous by any way you look at it.
This is your Old Mole Variety Hour. Bill Resnick here for The Mole, talking to Stephen Zunis. We've been discussing the murder of journalist Jamal Khashoggi. It arises out of a lot of things, and then we've spoken about them. Stephen, it seems to me that if Trump and Mohammed bin Laden, MBS, Mr. Bone saw after the dismemberment of Khashoggi, what's become his nickname, if those people stay in power for very long, there's the planet's in deep trouble and the Middle East is in deep trouble. They may not, though. It seems to me there's lots of possibilities that they would be displaced, but that would not be enough. It seems to me we really have to move towards a very different way of using the vast wealth we have available to deal with fulminating climate change in a relatively short time. It seems to me, though, that there are movements now. More and more people are beginning to understand that there are movements all over the world. You talk about mass movements and mass nonviolence being able to bring down regimes. It's not inconceivable that at some point fairly soon, when the people wake up to the threat to them and their children and grandchildren, that is the climate threat and other threats of totalitarianism, that we could see those movements. Why don't you expand on those ideas?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I think among the obvious benefits of going to more towards renewable energy, such as solar and wind and others, that the demand for oil is dropping. And Saudi Arabia is not near the largest country in the Middle East in terms of population, but it's powerful because of the oil wealth and because so much money has been transferred from Western nations that consume oil to the Saudi royal family, and they've gotten this wealth and power as a result. And I think it's, as we spend less money on oil, even before they run out of it, there's going to be a reduction in their kind of power and influence. They will not be able to buy off the Saudi population completely. I think one problem is that, as you know, I am a great advocate of the power of strategic nonviolent action to bring down authoritarian regimes. I've written about such struggles around the world, and particularly in the Middle East. And we saw how in Yemen, there was a pro-democracy movement that ousted their dictator, but unfortunately, U.S.-Saudi deal ended up putting in the dictator's vice president, the General Hadi, who ended up creating such a mess that you had the Houthi rebellion, the Saudi intervention, and all the horror that has gone down subsequently. But you've seen popular movements in Kuwait lead that monarchy to open up to an extraordinary degree to, while still semi-authoritarian, far more open and liberal than most countries in that part of the world. We saw the movement in Bahrain almost succeed were it not for the Saudi intervention. So we are seeing some signs of change within the peninsula. Unfortunately, I think Saudi Arabia is going to be one of the last to change, in part because of their enormous wealth, being able to buy off dissent to some degree. Another problem is what dissent there is often even more hardline Islamists, which leads many Saudis to think, well, better to have a semi-reformist autocrat like Mohammed bin Salman than to let the real crazies take over. And that sort of kept some people in line as well. But I think we do have a young population, which, like young Arabs elsewhere, is more literate, more worldly, more secular, has more democratic impulses. And I do think as this generation gets older, they're going to be starting to put more and more pressure on change. And so I do think we will see some major shifts in Saudi Arabia eventually, but it's going to take a while. I mean, the bigger question in the short term is if the international community lives up to its responsibilities and really tries to distance itself from Saudi Arabia, if there are some clear losses in terms of sanctions, in terms of arms transfers, and in terms of not going to these big fancy meetings and these big juicy contracts and that kind of thing. If Saudi Arabia starts really feeling the heat, I can imagine in some kind of internal coup of some more moderate, less repressive forces taking place. But I think in the long term we'll see even greater change because the kind of system they have there just is not sustainable on a whole number of levels.
Stephen Souness, thanks so much for talking to us. Keep up your writing and activism and struggles. Thank you.
Well, my pleasure.
Okay.
That was Bill Resnick and Stephen Souness talking about potential for change in the Middle East in response to climate change and authoritarian regimes. Now here is Fran Michel with more on that in her well-read Red.
Good morning. This is Fran Michel. Today's well-read Red reviews some of the intersections between climate change and authoritarian violence. In the most recent report from the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, those conservative scientists have finally sounded the alarm, though many commenters have noted that the report starkly underestimates the problem. Portland has already warmed by 1.2 degrees Celsius, well on our way to that 1.5 marker. I wouldn't take any bets on the yearly wildfires going away. An even bleaker picture of the future emerged from the Trump administration in a draft statement written to defend freezing federal fuel efficiency standards for trucks and cars. The argument was basically that the climate is warming so much that reducing emissions would have only a trivial effect. Joe Lowndes, in a post available on the AnarisProject.org, notes that although many have seen it as contradictory for the administration to go from denying climate change to predicting a 7-degree Fahrenheit increase over the next century, there is, quote, good reason for them to now endorse this second position, it makes much more sense to the proto-fascism of this regime. Accepting eco-catastrophe as a fait accompli allows them to ratchet up their cherished extraction industries and roll back environmental regulations in the short run and prepare for the brutalities of authoritarian rule in the long run. Imagine the kinds of violence, repression, and control that can be justified by increased food and water scarcity, the abandonment of coastal and desert cities, mass cross-border migrations, growing internal refugee populations, and a collapsing economy. End quote. This makes it sound a bit as though the environmental catastrophe is just an excuse for increased authoritarian rule. It presumably is and will be an opportunity for the proto-fascist regime to increase militarized accumulation and violent repression. But there are further interconnections. Christian Parenti, in his 2011 book Tropic of Chaos, Climate Change and the New Geography of Violence, describes a catastrophic convergence, the collision of political, economic, and environmental disasters, which compound and amplify each other, one expressing itself through another. While the Tropic of Chaos referred to in the title lies between the tropics of Cancer and Capricorn, a region ravaged by imperialism, Parenti also notes that the developed economies are only neo-fascist islands of relative stability, fortress societies marred by the politics of xenophobia, racism, police repression, surveillance, and militarism, and moving further toward what he calls the politics of the armed lifeboat. But, he adds, a world in climatological collapse, marked by hunger, disease, and violent social breakdown, will overwhelm the armed lifeboat. Eventually, all will sink into the same morass. But the relation between climate change and proto-fascism is, again, not just one in which the two problems contingently converge and amplify each other. Climate change and proto-fascism can also both be understood as themselves consequences of capitalism, more particularly of the inevitable crisis of capitalism. It is not just, as many have argued, that capitalism in its current form prevents taking the necessary actions to prevent and ameliorate the problems of climate change, but also, further, that the internal logic of capitalism itself requires economic growth and prioritizes profit-seeking above all other needs. As Ajay Singh Chowdhury puts it in a recent article from N+1, it's a system that requires infinite accumulation in a finite world. Capitalism has not simply steered the global human ecological niche off course, it has driven us completely into a ditch. High carbon economic growth and exploitative resource use are constitutive of this system, not incidental to it. As the finite world has been depleted of fossil fuels, the remaining petroleum sources are more and more difficult to exploit and have offered decreasing returns for increasingly toxic methods. But fossil industries have simply doubled down, producing more than half of all atmospheric carbon since the Industrial Revolution just in the last 40 years. And more than half of that has come from just 25 corporate and state entities. That includes the Pentagon, of course, the world's largest polluter. So climate change is caused by capitalism and by the apparatus of violence needed to maintain it. So too, a common analysis of fascism, or proto-fascism, or neo-fascism, sees it as a manifestation of capitalism and exhaustion. John Bellamy Foster, characterizing the present administration as neo-fascist, points out that in periods of systemic crisis in which property relations are threatened, such as the Great Depression of the 1930s or the stagnation and financialization of recent decades, conditions may favor the rise of fascism. Thus, both neo-fascism and climate change are caused by capitalism, and both, moreover, have their most damaging effects on the already oppressed and vulnerable. There's an entire section of the 700-page IPCC report that deals with social issues and concludes, among other things, with, quote, very high confidence that climate change and climate variability worsen existing poverty and exacerbate inequalities, especially for those disadvantaged by gender, age, race, class, caste, indigeneity, and disability. End quote. So how, in this world of widening inequality and mounting suffering, does the extant political hierarchy maintain itself? Through force. By arming lifeboats. As Christian Williams and others have argued, the police have always been a force to protect private property and white supremacy. The exercise of legitimated force is now increasingly profitable, as well as crucial to maintaining current hierarchies. In short, neo-fascism and climate change arguably emerge from shared causes, have overlapping consequences, and are mutually reinforcing. But there is reason for hope, and for continued action. Parenti notes that climate shocks can shatter oppressive relationships and open possibilities for progressive organizing and resistance. Just last week, Kinder Morgan canceled one of its planned pipelines. And though they were not allowed to mount a full necessity defense, the last of the valve turners were recently acquitted. Activists have been ramping up both direct resistance and legal actions, and communities continue developing plans and actions that can slow the damage and move us toward justice. As Rebecca Solnit has pointed out, taking action is the best way to live in conditions of crisis and violation, for your spirit and your conscience, as well as for society. For the Old Mole, this has been Fran Michel.
The agenda's been reset, you can bet we're in for it's not postmodernist, it's not post-feminist, it's not the end of history like they promised. It's not post-structuralist, but post-industrialist, it's a new age of the fist. Pops, this, it's a new age of the fist. Pops, this.
You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM and the Monday Old Mole Variety Hour. You just heard music from Alistair Hewlett's The New Age of the Fist, following Fran Michel's Well-Read Red on the intersections between climate change and authoritarian violence. With us is Mary Christina Wood, professor of law and faculty director of the University of Oregon Environmental and Natural Resources Law Center. She has spoken and published extensively on the climate crisis and originated the approach called atmospheric trust litigation to hold governments worldwide accountable for reducing carbon pollution within their jurisdictions. And her research is being used in cases and petitions brought on behalf of children and youth throughout the United States and in other countries. She is author of Nature's Trust, Environmental Law for a New Ecological Age, and co-author of the forthcoming book, The Dawn of Planetary Patriotism, A Citizen's Call to Climate Defense. It's great to have you back on KBOO, Mary Wood.
Thank you so much.
Well, next week, the Federal District Court in Eugene will begin the Juliana versus United States trial, at least I'm not sure if it's happening next week, given the news this morning, but it's a lawsuit brought by young people that charges the U.S. government for creating policies that encourage climate change. Tell us about this case and its significance.
Well, it's called the biggest case on the planet for a reason. As most of your listeners know, we are careening towards what United Nations Secretary General calls an abyss. We have about 2 years left to take decisive action to begin lowering carbon emissions before we enter a state of runaway, a state where we lock in the potential for runaway heating. And so the matter could not be more urgent. 21 youth are suing the federal government, the Trump administration, to force a plan that's enforceable to lower carbon dioxide emissions and draw down excess carbon from the atmosphere. And they are bringing the suit based on constitutional rights that are very well established, rights to personal security and family autonomy and equal protection. And they have gained tremendous momentum. The trial is scheduled to begin on Monday, October 29th.
Do you know anything about, I thought I heard on Democracy Now! This morning that the Supreme Court had intervened to postpone the trial again?
Yes, here's the latest development. The Trump administration has made desperate moves to stop this trial. And quite obviously, the fossil fuel policy of the United States is on trial in this case. And so the Trump administration made a petition to the Supreme Court. It is actually the fifth petition for a writ of mandamus made to federal courts to stop this case. And on Friday, Justice Roberts did issue a temporary administrative stay to allow plaintiffs, thus the youth, to file their brief. And so right now, the plaintiffs' lawyers are scrambling to get their brief in, and then the Supreme Court will decide whether or not to lift the stay in time for the trial to go forward on Monday. However, regardless, of the outcome of that, there's going to be rallies all across the country, either in the form of rallies supporting the trial going forward or protests in light of what's happened.
Now, this case was originally filed in 2015 against the Obama administration. Why have the lawyers for the Trump administration made so many attempts to thwart this trial?
Well, if a lawsuit is a very distinctive form for the truth. And basically, this lawsuit is expected to tell a story that will chill everybody's senses. And that is, the government has known all along and continues to know about the extraordinary danger of any continued fossil fuel policy of the United States. And so the Trump administration is trying to keep the truth out of the court by making all of these extraordinary motions to stop the trial. And they have lost thus far on every single motion. But they made another attempt just recently to the Supreme Court to try to get stopped on the eve of trial.
Now, I was looking at the youthvgov.org website to learn a bit more about the youthful plaintiffs. And it appears that there are quite a few from Oregon. Do you want to say something about these young plaintiffs in this case?
Well, there's 21, and they are all just remarkable in their own right. They're courageous. They've been fighting climate, most of them, their entire childhood. I encourage listeners to go to our Children's Trust website. It's called YouthVGov, and get to know these plaintiffs. There are pictures and bios and videos and so forth, and they are really carrying the weight of their entire generation and future generations on their shoulders, because if something is not done, the scientists agree that we are moving into a planet that won't be habitable.
And you mentioned the United Nations report. Now, certainly the United Nations and Secretary General are no flaming radicals, but yet they have recently highlighted just how grim prospects for the planet and its population are. Why has it taken so much? Why isn't the danger of climate change change registering with people? What is it that just makes it impossible for people to wrap their heads around the immediate dangers that a warming planet holds for all of us?
Well, I think the crux of it is that people just get this news in snippets, and that's the incredible value of this trial. All eyes of the world are focusing on this trial, and these youth are going to tell a story through their lawyers. They have 20 experts lined up that will tell not only about the dire situation and about how the government is violating their constitutional rights, but they will also tell about the way out. They have experts that are world-class experts saying it can still be done, and we can still pull back from this abyss or the climate tipping points by moving rapidly to renewable energy. And so in that sense, this trial lines up directly with what the United Nations is calling for.
Well, some people might be somewhat cynical about the real prospects for these young people to have a successful lawsuit against the United States. But are there other examples of where young people elsewhere in the world have made a case and where governments have had to pledge to begin pulling back from carbon emissions?
Yes, actually, there are lawsuits now around the world, either pending or being recently decided. One came in last week, a huge victory in the Netherlands, where the Netherlands Court of Appeals has ordered that government to reduce carbon emissions 25% by 2020. And there, too, the government said, oh, the court should not be involved. This is a political question and a policy question. And the court said, no, basically the survival of citizens is on the line, and this is a fundamental right at stake. And so the court just went ahead and ordered that emissions reduction. That is very much the model of all of these cases worldwide.
And so are young people in the plaintiffs involved in this case, you mentioned that they have had a long history of environmental activism. Do you see that there is this growing global movement of young people connecting these cases and the dangers of a warming planet with among each other, and how are they doing that?
Yeah, there most definitely is this surging movement, and the trial is expected to grow that by many orders of magnitude. Young people tweet about the trial. They Facebook it. They use Instagrams and little Vimeos. Young people around the world connect with these 21 plaintiffs. They know that they stand in the same position as the 21 plaintiffs. And so the wonderful thing about this is there's this side of growing democracy across the globe associated with this case. And they are unstoppable. I mean, the truth that comes out really can't be stopped. It's chilling.
Well, this project for participatory democracy is something that some of our other guests just were referring to on the show today. And that's also linked with the critique of this economic system, capitalism, and how it has, in its logic of constant growth and exploitation of the world's resources and people, made it impossible for communities to create alternative economic systems. Is this something that this movement is also considering?
Well, it really is. You know, I often tell people, don't wait for the law to work. We can't get off fossil fuels until we get off fossil fuels. And what that means is to draw back from our reliance on big corporations to provide our daily needs. And so part of the climate movement is very much a resiliency movement where communities just get together and figure out how they can live with a lower carbon footprint. It's an exciting thing. It's about the sharing economy. It's about building community. And that has to progress because society will not and cannot change and should not change in the legal system alone. It's got to be everybody pulling together. This is all hands on deck time.
Well, Mary Wood, talk about some of the actions around the state surrounding the event next week and how people can find out about them.
Yes, there are rallies planned across the country, actually. I just checked the website youth.gov. And basically, citizens are going to their federal courthouses to support this trial or perhaps to protest this delay. Although, if it goes forward, there's going to be just massive enthusiasm, I believe, in these rallies. And so those will happen on Monday, October 29th, and they're all listed on youth.gov.
Okay. And before we let you go, Mary Wood, we have to ask you about your role in these climate change lawsuits. You originated this concept of atmospheric trust litigation. Do you want to just tell us briefly about that and how that has evolved over the last some years?
Yeah. So I'm not a lawyer in this litigation. I'm a law professor only and a commentator, but I did, when Hurricane Katrina struck, I knew that environmental law would never save us in time. And so I applied the public trust principle to the climate crisis and developed an approach called atmospheric trust litigation. And the group formed Our Children's Trust in 2010 to take that forward. And so I've been just amazed at the global momentum that this has gained. And it's now a race for the planet, a race for our children's future. And I think it just continues to draw more and more and more people in each day.
That's great. And do you want to say something about your forthcoming book, The Dawn of Planetary Patriotism?
Well, yes. It's about citizens' role in climate crisis. It'll be a simple book that offers suggestions for citizenship. How do citizens actually create a different world for themselves without waiting for government to respond? And yet, how do they also press government to not violate our constitutional rights by pursuing this fossil fuel policy?
Well, we've got a couple minutes, Mary Wood. What would you say to listeners about how they can become active and informed in recognizing and doing something about the global climate crisis?
Well, that's a great question for your listeners. You know, I think at rock bottom, we live in a country that is supposed to be a democracy. The Constitution gave us rights against our government. It is absolutely unconstitutional to put citizens in direct peril. And yet that is what our government has been doing, building up to this point in time. And now the Trump administration is pushing its foot down on the accelerator towards that climate cliff. And so what citizens can understand is that we have three branches of government, and they must participate in some fashion in this third branch at this crucial moment in time where the fossil fuel policy is on trial. The best way they can do that is follow the case, write about the case, blog the case, and show up at the courthouse when the case is heard or in protest of its delay.
Well, thank you so much for your work, Mary Wood, and for joining us today on the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO. And we will post links to the youthvgov.org trial and also our childrenstrust.org. Thanks so much, Mary.
Thank you so much.
One day, take your damn time till you find the wrong way. Been a minute, the sky is the limit. The industry game, then you know that I'm a winner. Running in the rain, hands in the ground. Renegade, radical, lost and I'm found. Wanna make waves, beginning to strong. Trying to find myself amongst the mass that I've worn. Magic in the moment, mobilizing masses. Music that I'm making ain't mainstream, it's massive. Grasses, incredible on the other side. Life is a journey, just along for the ride. Yeah, and I'm taking it all. Ready for this moment when the snow won't fall. One day, ready for change. Nothing but 11 letters written in my name. Carved into stone, I'ma give them hell. Written into history, the story that I tell.
One day don't justify, we must live this life. Forever is a long way. One day don't translate, we must meditate. This moment is all we got.
Growing up on these streets, making music for free. You can reach for the sky, mama told me. Growing up on these streets, making...
That was music by Shoot Sakatal, one of the youth plaintiffs in the Juliana versus United States case. And here is Larry Bolden.
Good morning. I want to talk to you this morning about a truly scary book by a master of mysteries, Tana French, and her very latest novel, The Witch Elm, though it should really be spelled W-Y-C-H Elm, which is the name of a European elm, and the etymology of which is traced not to back to scary witches, but to the word bendable. Not sure why French or her editors decided to change it to W-I-T-C-H, perhaps because it sounds more frightening. I actually have a backlog of books I want to review, but having finished them weeks ago and memory not being my strong suit, I decided instead to talk about this just-finished mystery. I have to admit I'm happy to be out of its clutches. French's plots are so twisted and complex and her character so convincing that the book had a sort of stranglehold on me. I had to finish it quickly in order to get out from under its gloom. However, because it is such a wonderfully wrought novel, I cannot reveal much of the plot at all without spoiling the intricacy of the book. As one commentator puts it, due to her ingenious plotting, quote, make only one assumption. All of your initial assumptions are wrong, close quote. I can tell you that in the early pages of the novel, Hugo, the lead character, is surprised by burglars in his house and beaten almost to death, a skull fracture, jaw fracture, and many broken ribs. He awakens after many days to the sounds of machines beeping, wires attached to him seemingly everywhere, and with very little memory of either the events that put him in the hospital or, truthfully, of much of anything else. He does recognize his girlfriend, Melissa, his parents, and his two best friends, but with a drooping eyelid, a shuffling gait, and a deep sense of chaos and confusion, he cannot recognize himself as the person he was before the beating. Quoting from the book, I was aware that I was in big trouble here, but there didn't seem to be any way out. At the dark heart of the horror was the knowledge that it was inescapable. The thing I couldn't bear wasn't burglars or blows to the head, wasn't anything I could beat or evade or set up defenses against. It was myself, whatever that had become. Close quote. Hugo, being an only child, has never known the joys of siblings, but he does have two cousins, Susanna and Leon, with whom he is very close, and whom he shared summers and holidays with at their Uncle Hugo's house, the Ivy House, they call it, which is also the home of the Witch Elm. Hugo is almost better than parents because he pretty much gives his nephews and niece free rein and turns a blind eye to their parties with friends, and yet he is also a kind and wise protector. While recuperating at the Ivy House with his uncle and Melissa, his memory slowly begins to return and his many wounds slowly heal. But of course, French has much more in store for us. The death of a friend of the three cousins years before suddenly comes again to the fore. And since Hugo's very spotty memory leaves him pretty much defenseless against suspicions of others regarding the circumstances of that death, he comes to doubt his own nature and his own capacities. Quoting again from the book, "I had never been cruel before, never, even in school where I had been one of the cool kids and could have got away with anything. I had never once bullied anyone. Finding myself doing it now gave me a rush of savage, breathless glee and of wretchedness. Glee because it was a new weapon, although I'm not sure how exact it was supposed to protect me. Next time I ran into burglars, I could flay them with sarcasm, I suppose. And wretchedness because I had liked being a kind person, and now I couldn't find any way back to that. It seemed lost for good in some dark expanse of smoking rubble. And altogether, by the time my mother left every day, she and I were exhausted." Close quote. While the sarcasm and unkindness are originally directed only at his mother, with whom up to his hospitalization he had been exceptionally close, when he begins living with his uncle and his beloved in the Ivy House, his attitude begins to make itself known with his cousins, aunts, and uncles as well. No longer can he see himself as a kind person, and he soon has very little idea of who he really is. Quote, "That guy whom I had every right to be and who was gone for good, left behind on the other side of that unbreakable sheet of glass. And whereas in the hospital I had been able to tell myself that things would be better once I was home, now that that had turned out not to be true, I couldn't find any reason to think that anything would get any better." Close quote. Although there are some pretty awful events in this story, the really terrifying parts have to do with the state of mind of Hugo and his attempts to somehow wrestle some order into his fragmented memories. He needs to find himself, or create at any rate some semblance of the man he used to be. As Hugo cares for his uncle, who is dying of an inoperable brain tumor, both seem to be lost in shadow worlds. Typical of French, there are several places in the novel where she seems to hold out some promise for Hugo and for her poor readers, but each time it is dashed by some new twist. Only the scrap heap of his memories seems to offer any hope of health and redemption. Quote, "I had no idea which snippets were memory and which stemmed from some dark hallucinatory process deeper than imagination, involuntary and uncontrollable, simmering with a power and a reality all its own." Close quote. I'm a bit hesitant to recommend this novel, only because the web of confusion and strangled memories are so haunting, and as I mentioned, I yearned for release from French's incredible imagination long before the end of the novel came. No two of her mysteries are alike, and this, I think, ranks as the strangest of all. Stephen King says of it, "Terrific, terrifying, amazing, and the prose is incandescent." Close quote. Just so, I've been talking about Tana French's The Witch Elm. This is Larry Bolden for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Thank you, Larry. We also heard today from Bill Resnick, Stephen Zunis, Fran Michelle, and Mary Wood. You can share the podcast of today's show in a day or so after we post it on the KBOO website. KBOO programs are made possible by member support. If you'd like to become a member, go to kboo.fm and click on Donate.